From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Ring of Fire Studios in Pensacola, Florida. On our interfaith calendar, September 14th marks the Christian Feast of the Holy Cross. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
Sister, you and your fellow nuns have clearly gone rogue.
Well, you've got a bus tour coming up.
Yes, you and some other nuns.
Correct.
Guessing? Bunch
Correct.
Of nuns are getting on a bus.
Right.
That's a movie right there. Okay, nuns on a bus.
The spirit-filled Nuns on the Bus tours grabbed headlines in 2012 and 2013. Sponsored by the Network Lobby and spearheaded by Sister Simone Campbell, the Catholic Sisters took to the road 2 years ago to protest budget cuts to poverty programs. Last year, it was an urgent call for immigration reform. Now, somewhat unexpectedly, Nuns on the Bus 3 is set to roll September 17th. This time around, the focus is on empowering voters in the face of big money flooding into the midterm elections. And we'll continue our tradition of a sincere State of Belief send-off when Sister Simone joins us later on this week's show.
So there's an atheist who's a member of the Air Force stationed at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. He was forced to take an oath that included the words, "So help me God."
In this country, you don't need to be able to fly a fighter jet to be ordained to ministry. So why is the United States Air Force refusing to permit a long-serving airman who happens to be an atheist to re-enlist unless he swears an oath before a God he doesn't believe in? The requirement is unconstitutional and profoundly cheapens religious faith by demanding an insincere and dishonest oath from a member of the armed forces who for years has been entrusted with safeguarding our nation. I'll talk with American Humanist Association Executive Director Roy Speckhart.
The privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers.
Can a Christian vote for a Democrat?
It is the departure of government from God that's got us in the political, social, economic, and familial chaos that we're experiencing today.
I'm not ashamed to say that I believe in God and I believe in His Word. The Bible teaches us no one has all the answers, only God does.
Now, this guy's not running for the local pastor position. He's running for Senate.
With just weeks to go before the midterm elections, we're seeing a predictable flurry of faith-based electioneering across the country to equip both candidates and voters to better avoid the destructive conflation of religion and politics. Interfaith Alliance has published updated guides for both. We take this very seriously. That's why on this week's show, you'll hear from John Pomerantz, a leading elections attorney and the legal advisor to Interfaith Alliance's Election Guides team. But first,
on 9/11, I lost my youngest brother, Bill Bethke, in line of the direct first plane that hit. And from the very beginning, I wanted to make sure that this was not going to be something that turned me into looking for violence and retribution.
This past Thursday marked the 13th anniversary of the attacks on our nation that on September 11th, 2001, changed so many things for all of us. Those changes pale, however, in comparison to the changes endured by the families and loved ones of the innocent Americans who were killed on that terrible day. Over the years, I've watched in amazement the emergence of one group of survivors who've organized themselves under the banner of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. With profound courage and generosity of spirit, members have worked tirelessly to, in their words, share what they have learned as a result of their losses and what they've gained by reaching out to the rest of the world. The organization has developed a bus ad calling for unity and interfaith tolerance. The message is, "Let's build bridges, not walls. Hate hurts. Hope Heals. So I'm humbled to welcome the Reverend Myrna Bethke, a United Methodist pastor and member of Peaceful Tomorrows, to State of Belief Radio. Reverend Bethke, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm afraid that looking back on these 13 years since the attacks of 9/11, we've all too often seen that tragedy used to feed fear and hate. So let's start by taking a little bit of time to talk about what Families for Peaceful Tomorrows are doing to combat that.
For me, and I think much of the group, we look to open doors through education and shared experiences, particularly with persons of other faith traditions mm-hmm. than our own and other cultures. So, for example, one of the great opportunities I had after 9/11 was to travel to Afghanistan in June of 2002. We had persons who were Jewish, persons who were Christian and also Muslim. Mm-hmm. And we spent those 2 weeks traveling around meeting and sharing our experiences of grief with persons who were also deeply grieving, given all of the events that had been going on in Afghanistan for the past many years. That, for me, I think, is how you start erasing the power of fear and anger when you realize that we have so much in common and so many shared experiences. And when you hear the stories of other people, they become not just names and figures, but they become someone that you know and care about.
Yeah. Why is Islamophobia such a focus of your work right now?
People are so afraid of people of the Islamic faith traditions because I think our media perpetuates that Islam is a faith that is bent towards violence and hatred. I cringe every time I hear in our news that Islamic terrorists did something because there are many times when Jewish and Christian terrorists do things, but that's not how they're identified. And so I think that we have a lot of work to do in terms of taking away some of the misconceptions of Islam. I remember back when the second Gulf War started, we had an interfaith peace service in my congregation. And one of the youth who came was a 12-year-old girl from Egyptian who was from the nearby mosque. And we met in small groups, and she said to us, "I'm just a 12-year-old girl. I want to go to school, and I want to learn. I'm not a terrorist. I'm just like you are." And yet how many people in her school had branded her a terrorist just because she was Muslim.
Right. Your sensitivities are so good and so right on to where they need to be. It makes me want to ask you, if I may, about your personal connection to that terrible day and how you've been able to move from grief to this kind of generosity of spirit.
It was my youngest brother who died on that day. I'm the oldest of five children. And I can vividly remember that day as being one of numbness and confusion and a lack of information because we have never actually received any official news of my brother's death in terms of remains. But what I found for me that night was that the church had been a place where faith was nurtured to such a degree that I could respond out of my faith tradition and not give in to fear and anger as a way that I was going to respond. Now, that does not mean that there was not fear and anger. And I still remember very vividly the service we had at my church that I led that night. And we read Psalm 137 in its entirety to express our anger. Psalm 137 ends with the hope of the Israelite people that the heads of the Babylonian babies will be dashed against the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it ends on that angry note, but there's no sense that that psalm was ever to have been acted out, but it gave rise in a situation of powerlessness for the Israelites to shout and scream at God. And so we gave that anger and fear to God, knowing that God can handle it, but that's not how we were going to go out and behave in the world.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how you got involved with Families for Peaceful Tomorrows.
I saw a press release come through the United Methodist News Service that this family group had started, and as soon as I saw that press release, I got in touch with the family group and was involved from the very beginning of the group starting mm-hmm. and going out and doing speaking events and then eventually traveling to Afghanistan.
When did the Afghanistan trip come in relation to 9/11 and the grief you were going through?
The trip was in June of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about 9 months later.
Uh-huh.
And the Taliban had got out of power in that January of that year.
Yeah.
And I was there during the time that the Afghani people were electing their president and holding elections for their council members.
Yeah. Knowing what that engagement did for you in a very crucial time, how can we help duplicate something like that for people who don't have the opportunity to go to Afghanistan and simply get the message that comes across the evening news, some places better than others?
I think one of the hardest things to do, but I think is a necessary thing to do, is to actively seek out persons of different faith traditions and to get involved and to ask questions and to visit one another's different services and learn from them. I was privileged in my church at that time. There was a very active mosque who wanted to help teach us and educate people about Islam, and they're very open to having us involved. I spoke at their mosque after I came back from Afghanistan. They spoke at our church, and we just learned and grew from one another. And that's, I think, something that's really crucial and often missing
mm-hmm.
with people. They're content to hear what the news says, and then they just assume that's how everybody is, and it's just not that way.
Yeah. Myrna, what more do our listeners need to know about the group Peaceful Tomorrows, and also tell us how our listeners can support that work?
To support the work, you go on our website, which is peacefultomorrows.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very diverse group of people that come at the work for different reasons and from different perspectives, not all faith-based perspectives. Many mm-hmm. are, but some are not. And also, we've expanded some of the work that we are involved in, particularly in issues around Guantanamo Bay and the imprisonment of so many people there, and what is the just resolution of Guantanamo Bay prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at Islamophobia, but we also continue to push for what are peaceful ways to resolve conflicts in the world when we're so often drawn right into violence instead of other possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Myrna Bethke is a United Methodist pastor and a member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. On September 11th, 2001, she lost her younger brother in the attack on the World Trade Center in New York City. Reverend Bethke, I understand how profoundly you continue to feel your loss, and it's precisely because of that that your work for peace in spite of grief is so inspiring. And I'm very grateful to you for sharing it with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much.
News broke recently of a serving member of the United States Air Force being told, in effect, to swear an oath to God or be blocked from re-enlisting, but the airman happens to be an atheist, and it's essential that in a pluralistic society such as ours, the outrageousness of the situation is not lost on any of us. The American Humanist Association has lodged its objection to this Air Force requirement, and I'm very pleased to be joined by my good friend Roy Speckhart, who serves as executive director of AHA. Roy, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Glad to be on. Thanks for having me.
If you would, start by talking about this Air Force policy. I think it's new, isn't it?
Well, it's somewhat new. There is a form that's filled out that used to say that you could omit the words, "So help me God." And this process was apparently changed last fall, October 30th, 2013. And the reason it was changed is they compared it to the statute, and the statute didn't allow for that alternate way of swearing. Mm-hmm. It could be that the statute's been that way for quite some time. They're saying now that it'll take an act of Congress in order to allow them to change it.
So how did it get, who changed it?
So it wasn't the statute, we don't believe, that was changed in October of last year. It was the process, the forms. Someone, and we don't know who, someone in the military process there looked at it and said, gosh, this doesn't conform with the statute. Why don't we just cross it off?
I see. So you're not saying that it was a maliciously intended change, but just something that changed.
Right. It's likely that whoever did this felt like people should have to swear to God, whether they want to or not, and that that's appropriate. So I do think there's that piece of it going on. But yes, in the face of it, they say, well, look, it's just matching the statute. Of course, the federal statutes are overruled by the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Constitution takes precedence no matter what.
Well, isn't it likely, Roy, that since this policy has been in force, other atheist airmen have simply signed the oath, in essence, lying in order to re-enlist? And doesn't that then cheapen both sincere atheist convictions and religion as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. Not only should the military reverse their decision and allow this soldier to re-enlist as he should be allowed to do, but frankly, the statute should be corrected so that it says right in there that people can affirm instead of swearing an oath to God.
Mm-hmm. So how has the American Humanist Association involved itself in this case?
So we're representing the client, which is the Air Force airman who has been denied the ability to reenlist. Mm-hmm. We've reached out to the appropriate authorities there and asked for them to correct it immediately. Something like this did happen similarly, by the way, last year, but when we notified them of the problem, they corrected it the same day. They responded to us. They said they were sorry, that it was a mistake. This time, you know, a week has gone by, no response. And so we're actually, although we hadn't announced it yet, we're sending a letter demanding immediate action, or we're going to file suit.
I see. Roy, the Air Force says it would take an act of Congress to change this policy. If that's the case, the odds of that happening aren't great, are they?
Well, that's a good question. For one, I think they're mistaken in saying that it would take an act of Congress to change it, because for them to continue to not allow him to reenlist is actually goes clearly against the U.S. Constitution's article that says that there cannot be a religious test for public office.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they're going to lose this battle, whether it's sooner or later, on the courts.
Yeah.
But then I think that they're right in saying that Congress should go and change this. And I do think that Congress can recognize the value of this, even though we know there's folks in Congress who aren't so inclined to keep church and state separate. Mm-hmm. I think this is an issue, the idea of excluding a whole segment of the population from serving their country, that even conservatives in Congress will give some consideration mm-hmm. to supporting the rights of this individual.
I see. Has anyone else filed suit as well or threatened to file suit?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. So I know that this is a, you're right, certainly there are people having to re-enlist every day, and so you'd think that the person we're representing wouldn't be the only one in this boat.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if there are more that follow suit, assuming they don't back down very quickly.
I see. Well, Roy, since I've got you on the line, I want to talk about another case that
sure.
I know the American Humanist Association is working on. You all have a new campaign around the Pledge of Allegiance. Talk about that, if you will.
That's right. We have been working on the legal front on the Pledge of Allegiance, trying to convince state courts that it violates the equal protection laws to have a pledge that includes under God in it.
Mm-hmm.
Violates the rights of non-theists and others who don't believe mm-hmm. in one supreme being.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did this recently is we launched a campaign to ask everybody across the country, religious or not, to sit out the pledge until it's fixed. Because
mm-hmm.
we realize that it's not enough to bring it in the courts. We've got to get people out there on our side as well.
I know I didn't say under God in my school days. When did that change?
It was 1954,
54.
During the McCarthy era. As many feel, it was a response to the idea that we wanted to distinguish ourselves from communist, atheist Russia, and
that's
that we were in this state of fear and accepted that kind of limitation on our liberty in a way that, while it's difficult to reverse in Congress and in the politics today, I think it would have been difficult for it to happen today as well. But back then, it did.
You know, from my standpoint, that was another attempt by people of faith to make a bargain with God. We'll do this for you nationally if you'll just make things better for us and get rid of the communists. And that's how we've got a lot of religious language inserted into governmental documents. Well, who has the authority to change the wording of the pledge?
For the most part, it's done at the state level. And so if a state could say, look, this is the Pledge of Allegiance we want you to begin your school classrooms with, and then list the text mm-hmm. with it, one nation indivisible, mm-hmm. with liberty and justice for all, that's what we'd like to see.
Yeah.
Now, it could be that states decide to just drop the requirement for their classrooms to say this, but you know, some people might want that, but personally, I'd like to see it corrected instead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also tell us what else the American Humanist Association is working on.
Oh, we're keeping busy these days. And in fact, because of this campaign, we are hearing from a whole bunch of people across the country who are saying, yes, I tried to sit down and not say the pledge, but my teacher wouldn't let me. I was sent to the principal. My teacher said I was unpatriotic and didn't care about America because I was doing this. We're getting concerns from kids all across the country, and so we're going to be doing more legal work in this area for sure, representing them. We do represent people on a lot of church-state separation issues and are happy to work with other groups such as Interfaith mm-hmm. Alliance and such as Americans United for Separation of Church and State on issues like this.
Roy, tell the listeners, if you will, how they can follow the work of the American Humanist Association.
Check us out at AmericanHumanist.org on Facebook or Twitter. You could also check out this particular campaign at DontSayThePledge.org.
Roy Speckhart is the Executive Director of the American Humanist Association. The AHA has spoken out in support of an atheist member of the U.S. Air Force, who's been told that unless he swears an oath under God as part of the reenlistment process, he's out. Good grief. Roy, thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's been great.
As the midterm election campaigns shift into high gear now, issues of religion and politics inevitably come to the fore. Interfaith Alliance has released updated versions of our election guides to help both candidates and houses of worship navigate these waters. John Pomerantz is a nationally recognized election law attorney, widely respected for his depth of knowledge. John is a longtime collaborator with Interfaith Alliance in our advocacy work around political campaigning, and he is an invaluable partner in ensuring that the information we provide to candidates and houses of worship is as up-to-date and accurate as possible. John, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure, Wilton. Thanks for inviting me.
Do you think that enough voters actually take these issues seriously enough?
I think that people don't think about the legal implications. I think that they understand elections are important, and sometimes that gets people excited and riled up, and they want to get involved, and they just don't always think about whether or not it ought to be their church or their synagogue or their mosque that ought to be involved in it.
And, you know, typically, John, I find that they think other people's houses of worship should pay attention to it, even if they don't.
I think that's right.
Well, what about candidates? Is it the same for them?
Well, candidates, of course, they're focused on winning their election, and that's all right. That's what they're supposed to be about. And they certainly don't think about whether they might be getting their friends in trouble when they try and speak at a church or get a church mailing list or something like that.
If a candidate breaks the IRS regulations, it's not the candidate that gets punished for it. It's the house of worship in which the candidate made the mistake.
Oh, that's absolutely right. They'll be just as elected, and they won't have to pay any sort of fine at all. But the charity or the church that helped them, they're the ones that are going to get in trouble.
How can we help people understand where the line is drawn between appropriate and inappropriate, legal and illegal?
Right. It is hard, and the IRS, unfortunately, in Congress, hasn't made it any easier for us because they haven't given us any real clear guidelines about what is or is not okay. Instead, they say that any time there's a question about whether or not a church has stepped over the line and impermissibly intervened in an election, they're going to evaluate it on a case-by-case, facts and circumstances basis. Now, that said, I think the benchmark, the rule that you need to follow is that if it looks like you're trying to help or hurt some candidate to get elected, that's a problem for your church. But it's perfectly okay for a church to do nonpartisan work to encourage their congregants to exercise their right to vote and to think about their vote in the context of their faith. I think that's entirely appropriate.
For example, John, a congregation could even do a voter registration campaign. They just can't do a voter registration campaign for people who are going to vote for only their candidate.
That's exactly right. They can do a voter registration campaign. They can drive folks to the polls. They can organize people to help volunteer at the polls. All of that's fine. But if it looks like you're favoring or disfavoring a candidate, that's a problem.
Is that really the kind of line in the sand of whether you're trying to advance someone or hurt someone?
That's it. The IRS has said you're not allowed to intervene in an election. And the way they interpret that is if it looks like you're trying to influence that outcome, that's your problem.
What comes to mind as one of the most common legal problems that comes up during an election campaign?
I think it's very common in any election for the members of a particular faith to feel more attached to one of the candidates, and there's a natural inclination to want to talk about that election in church. And I think that you have to resist that temptation.
Yeah.
There really does need to be a separation between the work of the church and the day-to-day politics, even though you may have somebody who's a member of your faith running for office or somebody who clearly shares very fundamental beliefs with you. You've got to keep that separation.
Even if you are convinced that one person is the person that needs to be elected for the good of your religion and the morality of the nation, it is not a violation of your free speech to discipline yourself to not endorse that candidate.
That's right. We're not saying that you as an individual member of that tradition can't go out and work for that candidate or contribute to that candidate if you feel deeply that they are the right choice for the country. The key is you're not supposed to use the charitable resources of the church to intervene in the political arena. Mm-hmm. So if you as a congregant want to go out there and knock doors and tell people to vote for this candidate, that it's very important, I hope you'll do that. I want people engaged in our democracy. But I don't want you to take advantage of the resources that have been supported by tax-exempt charitable dollars and use that to favor one candidate over another.
Let's talk about how listeners can get directly involved if they witness lines being crossed. They can do that by going to interfaithalliance.org/elections and filling out an Eye on the Election report. What should they be on the lookout for? Can you give them a couple of examples?
Sure. If it looks like there are political events happening on church property, or if a church is using its own methods of communication, say a newsletter or a website or a social media site, to communicate favorably or disfavorably about candidates, that's the sort of thing that would be a problem. One of the things we've seen in recent election cycles is churches giving their membership lists to candidate campaigns, and that's a problem just as surely as if the church had made a cash contribution to the campaign. So there's something to look out for.
So, John, okay, I want to complicate that just a little bit. So what happens if a well-intended member of a congregation shares the congregation's address book or contacts book, but the church itself doesn't endorse that?
Right. Well, the church isn't going to get in trouble with the IRS for that. Although I do think that the member of the church who shared that information might want to think about whether that is an appropriate use of a church directory and might really be invasive of the privacy of his or her fellow congregants.
John, do you see things getting better or getting worse in this regard overall?
I'm a born optimist. Well, not, I'm going to say I hope it's getting better. I think people are becoming more aware of this separation between the church and the politics of this country. I do think that the IRS is going to, again, take this up, and that increased enforcement will perhaps encourage people to think more carefully about this. For a number of years, there's been some question about the IRS and its ability to audit churches for violations of this law. And now we've seen some recent evidence to suggest that the IRS is again taking a look at churches and really going after some that may have stepped over the line.
There are religion-based organizations that actually are encouraging churches and their leaders to intentionally violate this. I mean, I know that's not right. But, John, what should be the response? I mean, should we be reporting those kinds of breaches of faith regarding elections, or should we say, well, that's really not none of our business, we'll just let someone else take care of it?
Well, I do think that there are a number of efforts that are based on a very certain belief that the IRS has somehow crossed the line in its enforcement against churches, in particular in this area of political activity. And they're trying to get churches to step up as test cases. I certainly sometimes tell my clients, well, it's really uncertain whether or not you can engage in this activity or that activity, and if you'd like to be a test case, I'd be glad to represent you. But realistically, I don't think anybody wants to be a test case, or except maybe a very few. I think if you're approached by one of these efforts, you should think seriously about whether or not you want to martyr yourself to prove their point. I wouldn't advise any of my clients to get involved in something like that, and we'll see what, if anything, happens to the groups that do.
John Pomerantz is a nationally recognized expert on the law governing lobbying and election-related activity by tax-exempt organizations. John, I'm really grateful to you for the important work that you do with Interfaith Alliance on these issues, and I'm thankful as well for you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Right here at my current firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg, and Eisenberg, we love working on this stuff, and I'm always happy to talk about it.
The last time Sister Simone Campbell, executive director of the Network Lobby, was with us on the show, we were talking about her brand new book, A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. Now, one thing seemed clear. It was going to be a long time before another grueling national bus tour put her and other sisters back out on the road. So what happened? Network has announced that on September 17th, the third bus tour will be heading out from Des Moines, Iowa, and here to talk about it is the original nun on the bus, Sister Simone Campbell. Simone, welcome back to State of Belief.
Oh, it's an honor to be with you, and yes, it is totally surprising that we're doing this. So glad to talk about it.
I really am both intrigued and thrilled about the theme chosen for this year's Nun on the Bus tour. Tell us about it.
The theme is We the People, We the Voters. And really what got us back on the road was we were realizing that big money is swamping our democratic system. Mm. And so far, big money doesn't vote. We vote. And so what we're about is creating voters for the 100%. That everyone is welcome to the table, but we're asking those who have a lot of money, leave your money outside the door, but bring yourself in so we can have a conversation about where are we going as a nation and how do we work together to really create this more perfect union, or the common good, as we call it in our tradition. So what we're about is pushing back against big money, but giving people hope. Their voice matters. Their voice counts. And so making sure that people vote, getting houses of worship, churches, synagogues, mosques, getting schools to commit to be 100% voters so that everybody gets out and votes this November.
Talk about your biggest concerns around the money issue.
Well, I think what happens with money is that there's so many advertisements, negative, there's pushback ads, misrepresentations, all kinds of moneyed-fueled advertising that then just gets people depressed, separated, isolated. It becomes way too complicated, and people just turn off. The thing that got me finally to agree to this bus trip was in the summertime, there was a poll release saying that 60% of the American public did not know that there was a November election. And it matters hugely that if we're to be a democracy, we've got to do the hard work of democracy. Mm-hmm. And that means slogging through this election cycle. But I think what happens is too often all these ads are seen by individuals in an individualistic setting. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is create community so that I'm nourished by the fact you're going to vote. And you might be nourished by the fact that I'm going to vote. And we can have differences of opinions, but we're all engaged in making our nation better. Mm-hmm. That's what we all want. But it just feels impossible sometimes. So I've been saying that hope is a communal virtue, and the only way that we can generate hope is together. Oh, and great. So our bus, we hope, will be a lightning rod for hope, and that all of us together can make our union better. Now, one of the things we're going to do on the bus, which I'm really excited about, is that we've got this beautiful wrap. It says, We the People, We the Voters, and we've got the various states that we're going to. But everybody along our route who commits to voting and mm-hmm. supporting voters gets to sign the bus. So by the end, we're going to have thousands of people riding the bus. So everybody can be on our bus. It's not just nuns on the bus, but it's all of us on the bus. Commit to vote. That's what we need.
Why did you decide the bus was the best way to highlight your concerns and engage voters?
That's a really good question, because I was resisting for a very long time. I thought, there's got to be another way. We need something new. But what I was told is that this has entered people's imaginations, and that people love seeing the bus turn out. Mm-hmm. And so if we can give a bit of joy in an otherwise bleak political landscape, I'm more than willing to do it. So a part of it is to bring joy, but the other part is to bring the practical reality that we want to get close to people and people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to a lot of low-income communities, we're going to the immigrant communities, we're having business roundtables, but it all requires some transport of some form, and we're not the high fancy, you know, fly in on the jet type.
Yes.
So
yes,
a bus gets us really close to people. We actually tried to plan the original trip with public transportation. Hmm. And so it was going to be a none on your bus. But you know what we discovered? In our nation, it is not possible to do much of a bus trip on public transportation. Hmm. It just wasn't possible in Iowa to figure out how to do it. So we had to surrender and create our own bus, but it gets us close to people. That's the only thing we care about.
Well, I do understand the significance of starting in Des Moines this,
yes,
this Thursday. And you've told us about the possibility of people signing the bus, but talk a little more about the activities you're planning during the stops.
We're going to various sites that are engaged with a variety of people in Minnesota. We're going to this site that does this wonderful work that provides voicemail for homeless folks so that they can get messages. And we're working with them to put in their voicemails about voting and helping them navigate, making sure that they're registered and then voting. In Iowa, we're going to several places where families gather to work with kids on school readiness and reading remediation, those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
and work with the parents on making sure that they're ready to vote.
Oh.
In Kentucky, we're really excited about working with some of the college students about how they can not only vote themselves for the first time, but also support other voters. And one of the things we've realized is that people need to be prepared to vote. People get put off by not knowing how to do it or being a little intimidated about the process, worrying that they don't have, because there's now so much messaging around mm-hmm. how you need ID and all this other stuff. So college students are fanning out across Kentucky to help people figure that out. So we're going to work with them, learn what they're doing, and then hopefully spread the information around. And then in the evenings, we're going to be doing town halls where we invite the 100% to come together, and we're going to have some civil discourse. I'm going to lead civil discourse, civil dialogue about what matters to people in your area. And we're inviting candidates to come and listen, not come and talk. Come and listen to what matters. Matters are of concern to the people in the area. And through facilitated conversation, we're excited. Our sisters are going to fan out around the town hall. We're going to do small group conversation about what matters and then pull it together in a summary and educate ourselves about what's happening. So I think we've got a good breadth of activities. I'm really excited about
it. Oh, listen, what you've just described, it just excites me to no end to know that that kind of thing will be going on. Now, if I understand this right, you're going to be on that bus through 10 states over a month, ending in Denver on October 20th.
Yes, that is true. I can't quite believe it. But there's one little caveat that we're doing bus activities in Denver, but we couldn't afford to bring the bus that far west. So we're actually taking ourselves without the bus, and we're going to have a van once we get to Denver. It just costs too much money to get it that far, but we're excited about it. We're going to be doing the same kind of programs and the same activities. So,
how can our listeners keep up with the schedule?
If you go to nunsonthebus.org, it'll take you directly to our website, and there's a glorious picture of a bus up there. And then it has various like buttons for each state that we're going to. And you can click on the button for your state, and it will show you the list of activities that we're doing, mm-hmm. the dates, the times, and if you want to RSVP, let us know you're coming. That would be great.
And if folks are listening who may not be able to make it out to one of the stops on the tour, do you have resources available for them?
If you're not in one of our states, we've got the other 40 states in the District of Columbia. We have resources up on our website, Nuns on the Bus, or networklobby.org. There's how to do a town hall in your own area. It's engaging in the important work of helping people vote, being a voter yourself, getting your community to be 100% voting. And then we're hoping people will let us know if you've taken the pledge, and we'll post it, give you some notice, notoriety, and encouragement along the way. The other thing that your listeners can do is we've gone modern, and so if they text the word nuns, N-U-N-S, to 877-877, you'll get a text back with some basic information, and then we can link you to your state's information about voting, about voter registration, and also we can connect you to your actual polling place and the issues that you're facing in this election. So there's a lot of resources.
Oh, boy, that's terrific.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's fabulous. It's a lot of collaboration among a lot of groups making this happen. I'm really excited about it.
Sister Simone Campbell's the Executive Director of NETWORK, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby. She's the author of the book, A Nun on the Bus, and that's what she's just about to be once again, as another Nuns on the Bus tour heads out this Wednesday under the banner of We the People. Simone, it's a vitally important issue, and I'm grateful that you and NETWORK are lending your visibility to it and affirming the importance of it. You know good and well that you have our prayers and wishes for safe travels and our gratitude for you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's an honor always to be with you. And this time on this bus trip, we the people hold the power. I am so excited that we can all vote. It makes a difference. Looking forward to it.
All I know to do is to say amen.
Amen. Okay. Thanks, Logan.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I'd like to say a big thank you to Mike Papantonio for once again welcoming us to the Ring of Fire Studios here in Florida, and to Scott Milliken, executive producer at Ring of Fire, for devoting so much of his time to the taping of State of Belief Radio. Without the financial support of State of Belief listeners like you, this show wouldn't be possible. If you made a donation this week, thank you. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. The kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that we strive to present every week is virtually impossible to find anywhere else. So please, consider helping us to keep this important work going. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews there, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Please stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that on Facebook and Twitter. We have a listener line. The number is 202-681-4246. We'll always be glad to hear from you. And we encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen as you do. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.